Welcome, everyone, to the latest episode of the Plow and Stars podcast. My name is Red Bernard. You can find me on Twitter at Red Bernard, and we are here with the usual crew, including the angry commie lawyer, who is at Cat Dad Eternal. We've got Doc Plague at I'm Doc Plague, and Pay My Rant at Pay My Rant. You can find this episode anywhere you normally get your podcasts, including Spotify and iTunes. You can reach out to us on the website at plowandstarspod.com. On Twitter, we're at plowandstars. Our Patreon is patreon.com/plowandstars. We want to give a special shout out to all of our Patreon subscribers. You really make it so rewarding for us. We're really thrilled to have so many people helping us out to make this podcast happen. We also have a Redbubble now, so you can search for us on Redbubble. Just search for Plow and Stars, and you can find some great art that we've had some members of the community that they've given to us to put on t-shirts and mugs and whatever other stuff you might want. So yeah, feel free to send us a Twitter DM or contact at plowandstarspod.com to let us know what you think of the episode, to give us any questions or critiques, or if you have anything you want to talk to us about. We also want to thank at Cathartic Skelly for production help with our episodes. So today we're going to be talking about a dreaded topic, which is how to talk to liberals. and the way we're going to be going about it is to we're just going to have a bit of a roundtable discussion to talk about our experiences with it, our theories about how best to do it. But definitely reach out to us if you have any ideas.
Yeah, for sure. And before we get underway, I want to reiterate the common theme of this podcast, which is that listening to it counts as like doing some kind of theory study, right? But not as doing anything practical in the world. So you should also, right before you listen to any of this, stop the podcast, go find an organization to affiliate with, or people to form a cadre with you if you can't find such an organization, or your organization is for some reason compromised, and go out and do something. Because doing something is infinitely more effective than listening to a podcast. Just being a subscriber doesn't mean that you're actually accomplishing communism. It doesn't make you a communist to read communist theory. The only thing that makes you a communist is going out, or a socialist. If you're not, if you don't identify as a communist, if you don't, you don't adhere to any of the various branches of communist theory, the only way to be those things is to go out and do them. That's what makes you a material socialist. All the other stuff is just fluff.
Yeah, and that also includes talking to liberals. Talking to liberals is great, and if you can make people move their needle towards revolution, that's wonderful. But you need an org to back you up on that kind of thing. So you need to be out joining and organizing with your fellow workers.
Right, and on top of that, talking to liberals one-on-one is itself a kind of recourse to liberalism, because it's an individual to individual way of attempting to facilitate systemic change. You, by convincing the five members of your close family and your 10 closest friends that communism is the correct way and that we all need to join in a revolution, you're not actually threatening the state. The only way to threaten the state is with mass action. And that's not achievable on a person-to-person basis. This episode about combating liberalism at home with your friends and your family is more really, I think, going to be about mental health and mental stability for you than it is going to be about actually achieving something by converting people. Because even if you do manage to do it, I don't think that that's not really a mass action, right? That's something that you're doing to a handful of people.
Right, so why don't we start off with what are we talking about when we say liberalism and liberals?
Exactly.
Ooh, yeah.
I think that's a
I want to hear everyone's definition of this. I'm super interested what everyone thinks.
I feel like I have a lot to say on that, so maybe I should go last. Because I don't want to dominate the whole what is a liberal thing, but yes. I have like a historical perspective to give.
Sounds good. Pei, do you want to start?
Do I want to start? I mean, sure. I don't know.
What's on now?
I'll probably have like the most colloquial definition of a liberal. And for me, I would call a liberal as someone who like almost gets it, you know, like they're kind of close to some good ideas, and they might have some convictions that are you know, right as we would define them, but they are missing a willingness to go beyond their own comfort level to engage with systemic oppression in any meaningful way. And that's more of a theoretical kind of whatever definition, but that's the one I'm going with.
Nice. Doc, do you want to give your definition or will I go next?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I agree with Pei. I would kind of add that I have a difference between like capital L liberalism and then lowercase L, you know, liberal. You know, liberalism, you know, as it is, you know, kind of this adherence to capitalism, and a violent anti-communist mindset. Whereas you have liberals, lowercase L, there's a whole spectrum of liberals, as we saw, you know, last night with the debates. You have kind of people who are more progressive and people who are certainly on the more conservative end. You know, obviously the more progressive are going to be further left and more, you know, closer to where we are, but within the idea of kind of liberals in, you know, this kind of two-party U.S. system, there's no one that is willing to, as Pei said, you know, challenge the systems of oppression, really.
People like comfortable with the status quo, you know?
Yes.
People who like experience some privilege in a way that insulates them even from the knowledge of like the oppression that our society generates.
Yeah, I like those definitions. And mine is going to be maybe a little bit more theoretical. And I don't even know if it's a complete definition, but the first thing that I think about when I'm thinking about what makes someone a liberal is their idealism. And we've talked about this in previous episodes, but you know, when we're talking about Marxists are supposed to be focused on the material world. You're supposed to be thinking as a materialist, which is to say that between the material and the ideal, that is the real stuff, physical stuff in the world, and the relationships between those things, and the ideal being what happens in your brain, you know, the material is primary. And I think that a lot of liberals are the opposite. I think a lot of liberals are idealists in that they believe that ideas control. And so what that leads to is a lot of liberals who are uncomfortable with the practical realities of the capitalism and the imperialism that they live under, right? There's lots of people who say, well, I didn't want the Iraq war, or, you know, I am all for, you know, increasing social safety nets, that kind of thing, because I realize that people are suffering. But as far as the ideas go, they still have an idea of what capitalism ought to be, that we can have a gentler, kinder, nicer capitalism. And that's like a kind of primary characteristic of a liberal to me, is someone who wants to, who doesn't want to question the ideas that are the fundamental ones to the society we live in, who would rather only kind of nibble at the edges of the things that they see as problems without, again, as both Doc and Pei have said, without wanting to address the actual systemic issues. And again, I think that's because they're focused on ideas. And if you tell the correct story about capitalism, if you look at it through the lens of like bourgeois economics, it looks great in that everyone can be made better off without anyone being made worse off. That's something that you hear over and over and over again in your intro to economics courses. The fact is that as an idea, that's fine and dandy, but when it comes to actually applying to the real world, it never works out that way.
Let me jump off of a little bit of Red's definition, and I want to give something that's like an analytical category for liberalism, and then we can talk about, as Doc said, lowercase L liberals. That is, you know, your what you would consider the center right or center left of the political spectrum in the U.S. and the center of the political spectrum in Europe. Liberalism, as an overview, as a general idea, is an idealist ideology. There are very few materialist ideologies prior to the 19th century, for various reasons. They just didn't have the kind of self-justificatory power that seemed to back up idealist ideologies. that is, ruling classes tend to prefer ideologies that explain in a good way why they are the ruling class. And materialist ideology doesn't do that. It just explains the world as it is. And one of the things that's bad about hierarchical class society is that it's an unstable system when examined materially. So materialism doesn't have a lot of staying power after, you know, like the early 300 or 400s CE. So after that, all of the material ideologies kind of tend to drop out in the West. And there are still some that persevere in the East, but this is, I think, in order to restrain ourselves and kind of make this not a 20-hour lecture series, we'll have to focus just on the narrowest possible set of ideologies rather than talking about philosophy throughout time. But and please, anybody, feel free to disagree with me. Liberalism, as it exists today, exists in contrast to conservatism that, like a Brownian conservatism, that's not practiced at all anywhere in the West anymore, except in advanced fascist states. So both communism, in a way, you may hear this, this sounds sort of like horseshoe theory, because there is a grain of truth in horseshoe theory, that both communism and other illiberal ideologies fall outside of the liberal spectrum. That is, liberalism is based upon an individualist understanding of the world and the functions of people in the world and in politics. Liberalism came out of the Enlightenment and is a result of the collapse of absolute monarchy and the beginning of the new bourgeois class. And it is itself a very petit bourgeois ideology. It springs from the bourgeoisie and the petit bourgeoisie. You can see that liberalism takes off in the colonial revolt in the US and in the French Revolution. These are liberal revolutions. Looking back on it, we can say all that we want about the failures of the French Revolution to complete the revolutionary arc and the failure of the U.S., we'll call it a revolution, really a colonial revolt, to achieve anything other than changing who the ruling stratus was. But they were revolutions of a sense, and they were liberal revolutions, even though there were slaveholders in the U.S., and even though there were powerful bourgeois interests in France, because they, at that time, constituted the revolutionary class, or the class with the most revolutionary potential. That's not to say, of course, that there were not other classes with revolutionary potential that could have completed the revolution. The Hébertists and the sans-culottes in France could easily have completed the revolution had the Thermidorian reaction not taken place. The smallhold farmers and slaves in the U.S. could have completed the U.S. revolution had the new system been not so sturdy as to defeat all of the incipient attempts to overthrow it. But basically, when we talk about liberalism, when communists in general talk about liberalism, I think it's important to know that they're talking about both what we in America would consider conservatives and liberals. That is, people whose foundational ideology is the belief that individuals on their own influence the world in such a way as to make history, that individual choices matter on the world stage, that individual interiority, that is the world of ideas inside each person, is the point of reference from which to understand all political action and all philosophy. As communists, we reject all of those theses. I think everybody here agrees with me. None of those theses are correct or useful. We reject the individual as the foundational building block of politics. It is rather the material world that is our building block of foundations and the community. We reject the individual's experience as being more valid than an attempt to reach an objective understanding of a material situation. And we reject the idea that individuals can, on their own, influence the outcome of history. And you may be saying to yourself, well, there have been moments in time when an individual choice did make a difference. But I would say to you that had that individual in that time that you're thinking of not made the choice that they made or not been present, some other individual later or prior would have made it. And that without the systemic inertia that allowed that choice to carry weight, it would have made no difference. For example, let's say we were to hypothetically, just as a thought experiment, a rogue cell of anarchists were to assassinate President Trump tomorrow. That would be what we would call adventurism. Brett, go ahead.
Oh, I was actually just going to say that I was just going to agree with you about the importance of individualism in the kind of like liberal psyche, and my example for that would be the notion that a particular you will often see this, that when you criticize a particular systemic issue, you say, oh, you know, cops are being very violent towards protesters or towards racial minorities or something like that. A lot of times the liberal knee-jerk reaction is to say, oh, but like, it's not as though they're racist individually. Like, they probably, you know, feel like black people are fine or like protesters are fine, but this is just their job and they just have to do what they have to do. And you just immediately drill directly into the skull of the person and try and figure out what's going on inside their brain, because that's what really matters, is not how they hurt people, but what they feel inside. This, and that's like
this super touches on something that I've been thinking about a long time, which is the idea that your intention like doesn't negate the reaction that it causes in somebody else. And like your intention doesn't invalidate the experience of the other person's reaction, right? It's like a denial of an understanding of somebody else's lived experience. If I say to you, hey, this happened to me, a liberal's first impulse is to say, well, no, it didn't, or no, that didn't happen how you think it did. There's something else at play, or you didn't understand correctly your own experience. And I think that harkens back to what you were talking about too, Cat Dad, is this idea that liberals are so consumed with like the individual thought, the individual understanding, that unless they have experienced something in the world firsthand, they can't conceive of it or accept it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that actually is a very deep problem and is going to affect how I at least am going to suggest we talk to liberals, because as a just a piece of materialist philosophy, I think it's hard for people that have not reached a material condition that allows for them to break out of their liberalism to do that. And I would almost posit that it is impossible to argue someone who is not already at a point where they can be radicalized because of their material conditions or because of some axis of oppression that they've faced. It is impossible, I would say, to argue them out of liberalism. You can't, it's like trying to argue a fascist out of fascism unless they have had some experience that allows that to be that makes them prepared and activatable, then your words will fall on deaf ears. And that's another very liberal idea, that we can just talk to people, and by talking to them, we can change their whole mindset, right? Like, I'm going to sit down and talk to you, and I'm going to make you understand that your point of view is wrong. Well, everyone has a self-consistent set of beliefs, and where they're not consistent, people create intentional blind spots that they will not examine. So unless you are radically dedicated to self-examination, and I would like to throw out that that is one of the principles of Marxist thought, that we should be ruthlessly self-critical and ruthlessly re-examine our positions on every single issue in order to prevent ourselves from falling into this hole. It is a hole nonetheless. And again, it's another liberal problem with individualism, because these holes can be covered if we listen to our comrades who can see them where we cannot, and then allow ourselves to self-examine where those holes have been pointed out.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm agreeing.
Yeah.
So and we might touch on this later. I don't know if we wanted to tie this back in later, but I did want to suggest that the notion of, you know, you're not going to be able to talk a liberal out of liberalism. They have to experience something first. You know, I think that's a good reason to say it's very important, if you are going to try to talk to liberals, to not try and convince them that their ideas are wrong, because the ideas are always unimpeachable, but rather to try and get them involved in something. And it can be something that they would otherwise agree with, but just to get them on their feet, so to speak.
I agree. And we actually have been having a pretty good discussion about this in the theory section of the Discord over at the Village Green Preservation Society, that Mao actually identified two methods of approach. The method that you use to approach cadre members, that's what he clarifies in combat liberalism, right? Where you're supposed to be ruthlessly critical and not allow your personal feelings for other people to prevent you from delving deep into theoretical disagreements and basically trying to root out liberalism in yourself, because we have all been raised in a liberal idiom and are filled with liberal ideologies that we have to combat in ourselves and in our cadre members. And then the other issue, which is how do you talk to people who are not members of your cadre? He talks about commandism, right? Where the party theoretically stands way ahead of the masses and they tell the masses, catch up or you can't organize with us. You have to hold the same advanced positions on communism that we do, or we're not going to trust you to organize with us. And commandism is a failing of communism. And it's a failing under Marxist-Leninist theory. The idea is that we cannot stand ahead of the masses, that we have to keep our theoretical stances intact while organizing with the masses and meeting them at the problems that they currently face. And it is only through that kind of organization that we can teach them through struggle, as Red said, get them on their feet to something where they can see, where they can have an experience that will make them activatable. But I think we're straying a little bit into exactly the how to talk section. And the last thing I wanted to say about liberalism is that in the great span of history, if an anarchist cell were, God forbid, to assassinate President Trump tomorrow, would that end fascism in the United States? Would the regime collapse? Would the state be gone the following day? And you can already see by the way I framed the question, no, obviously not. There would be somebody else to step into his place. There's institutions in place that make sure that the failure of a single individual doesn't mean the failure of the state. And this is all kind of inherited, this liberal ideology, from the ideologies that underpinned even medieval and classical notions, because those were all paid for by important people in the medieval and classical world. And it may be the case that in a medieval state, things hinged much more closely on the life or death of individual nobles. And those nobles like to hear stories about themselves. And so they paid troubadours to tell them stories about themselves. And the troubadours got more money doing that than they did making up stories for the common folk. So the stories for the common folk didn't have as much of a survival rating because they weren't written down. And the stories that the troubadours told became the models upon which the bourgeoisie modeled their ideology and their storytelling preferences. And that's why we have things like novels that are about, you know, plucky individuals who change the world. That's liberalism. And at its heart, that is the thing hardest to combat, because a liberal will want to say, I'm not going to use plastic straws, and I'm going to turn off the lights in my house when I'm not in a room, and I'm not going to run the water. And in so doing, I'm going to prevent climate catastrophe, because, you know, if everybody did what I was doing, we would all be good.
That's so true.
And right, we all know that's a bullshit argument, because even if every individual private citizen did that, the majority of climate catastrophe is being caused by the U.S. military and several large corporations. So
yeah, but
the whole idea.
Sorry, but I'm just going to say, like, how ironic is it that, like, the people who believe most in the value of individuals are the ones that are upholding institutions that, like, work to the detriment of individuals. It's like, there's a lot of, like, paradoxes that liberals have to kind of live with, right? Like, things that they're not willing to question or examine, because if they did, like, your whole, like, everything's a lie. Everything's a lie. Like,
right. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing if you ever, I'm sure the listeners here on the podcast have done this. Stand back and look at the history that you've been told by the liberal individualist state apparatus that has constructed this history. And it is literally baffling to look at and realize how much of it is just complete and utter bullshit. It's just a made up story to keep you in line.
Yeah, I think it's important when we're talking about liberals to mention that they will generally fall in line with the kind of status quo ideology, which might be the case for all people at all times. I don't know. I've only lived in this society, so I can't say which is a very liberal one. You know, but at the moment, it goes beyond just liberalism into, like, neoliberalism, which, you know, the Margaret Thatcher said there is no such thing as society, right? Like, literally an attempt to destroy like social bonds. But when we talk about this, the status quo ideology, you know, I recognize perhaps more than most how alluring it can be, because I think I said this during my my episode where I talked about my radicalization. You know, I considered being someone who worked at the IMF or the World Bank or something like that. You know, I really did find the idea is so unimpeachable. You know, the idea of the models that they create are very, very convincing, very, very pure as far as the ideas go. You know, but that's the important thing to remember, is that when you're talking to a liberal, you can't just attack the ideas, because the ideas are in some sense kind of fetishized. They're almost magical. Mm.
I think that touches on something else, which is this idea that we can be using different words but saying the same thing, and we can be using different words and saying different things. It's just your connotations of what words mean based on your socialization and your degree of radicalization is going to be radically different from anyone who's trying to like meet you in the middle. So even if you have the same premise of like right and wrong, or these like basic nuggets that are the same, it can still be difficult to speak the same language.
Oh yeah, for sure. And it's very easy to become very angry as a communist very, very quickly when you're talking to a liberal.
Absolutely. Well, it's frustrating to have to say like, oh, people deserve nice things. Like, that's an annoying thing to have to defend. It's like, why do you feel like people don't deserve things? Like,
right. Or even more clear, right? Like, police shouldn't be beating people based on the color of their skin.
Right? Oh my God.
And the problem is that a liberal, at least a lowercase L liberal, will agree with you on all these topics and then not see the causes that lie underneath them. So where I find myself getting the most angry is when I'm like, look around you. We have lived in a proto-fascist state our entire lives. Think about all of the military indoctrination that we've been given. Like, just stop and think about it for a minute. It's not what it's like. Every, you know, liberals think that, you know, America is basically good, maybe a little misguided.
The cops and the military is there to protect you and make you safer.
Right. And when a cop does beat someone based on the color of their skin, that's an individual problem for that individual cop.
It's the same dialogue.
It's what happens in that guy's brain. That guy must be racist.
It's the same dialogue that we have in the media when someone comes forward about a high up person committing sexual assault. We immediately go to pick apart what that person was doing that caused themselves to be abused, instead of just saying like, okay, let's discuss the fact that we have people who exert physical power over others, and that's their job. And actually, we pay them to do that. Let's just examine the material facts here, instead of trying to invalidate this person who just was abused. Like, the impulse is not to console, it's to condemn.
Yeah,
Go ahead, Red.
I was just going to say, even when you find a very progressive liberal who does want to listen, who doesn't want to try and victim blame and say, what did the victim do to make this happen? They're still going to only look at the perpetrator's brain and say, what's going on in the perpetrator's brain? They must be some kind of monster. Without looking at all at the systemic issues that led to that situation.
And I think this is a good subject, right? Because a lot of liberals, lowercase L liberals, Democrats in the 90s, you know, when the Clinton scandal came out, they were like, oh, it's just sex. Like, why are we concerned? It's just sex. Don't worry about it. Without examining the power dynamic of the president of the United States and an intern in his office, the married president of the United States and an intern in his office. And they said, oh, it's just sex between consenting people. Right. But the very idea that simple consent is enough to whitewash the systemic power imbalances and the built-in patriarchal structure of society is simple liberalism, because it focuses only on the interior individual experience of the people engaging in the actions and completely negates the systemic positions that they hold inside a greater network.
Well, let's talk about Monica Lewinsky. I mean, this is a woman who was in her early 20s when this happened, fresh out of college, and the media dragged her through hell and back. They picked apart her appearance. They slut-shamed her. They sex-shamed her. This was at the advent of like the birth of the internet. It was like the first, it stands out to me because I lived through it as the first like widely recognizable occurrence of like cyberbullying, right? And like you see, it was just like a media frenzy for months and months and months. See how the system attacks people, even if they don't necessarily, like, they're not the ones in control of the narrative of stepping forward. You know, like, as soon as you speak up about what's happening to you, the institutional and societal impulse is to silence you. Because then you will disrupt
exactly.
the status quo.
And it's not... Yeah, not to delve too deeply into a topic of material feminism, because I think that's at least an episode or two of its own. But when society responds that way, there is a reason. We have identified an analytical reason why that happens. And it is because all social relationships, all gendered social relationships, are based off of power relationships that have to do with property and that have to do with the reproduction of the workforce. So the society cannot allow itself to be to blame for the abuse, the systemic abuse of women stretching back to the 1400s as a systematized, understood way of controlling reproduction and power and property. Because if it were to allow itself to be examined rather than the individual woman or the individual abuser, then people would have to step back and say, this continues to happen because our society is structured on it on a foundational level.
Yeah.
And the same is true, I think, of the Epstein stuff, right? Like, why do these people keep turning out to be sex predators? Because our society, on a foundational level, encourages
ooh,
this
ooh,
behavior.
Ooh, ooh, okay, sorry. This just struck a chord for me. There was something I saw on Twitter the other day about there was like a reunion of a Disney show, and this one actress wasn't invited to the reunion, and she was the only one to kind of like publicly insinuate abuse allegations against Dan Schneider. He's like this Nickelodeon big time producer in the like early aughts and like late 90s. He was behind like the Amanda Show, all these like contemporary ones. And you can go down kind of a rabbit hole researching this stuff because it gets scrubbed very quickly from the internet. These are some very powerful people, but there is a Reddit archive of someone who came forward about the kinds of ways that children are lured into these kinds of situations, systematically targeting the parents and the children with offers of fame and, oh, you can get an audition, you can meet this producer, all of these things, because what are kids grown up to want to be? Famous, rich, successful. So we reward and condone entire industries that are centered around the exploitation of children, of women, of all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. And the people who are doing the exploiting are the people who are the most powerful and in control of that, of access to that industry. They're the gatekeepers. And like liberals have to, I think, realize that it's not just down to one evil person doing a thing. It's a bunch of evil people together protecting themselves and insulating themselves so they can do right. this thing and no one can say shit about it.
Right. And so that's the real problem to get a liberal to understand, is that these things keep happening, not because there are bad people. There will always, of course, be people that have issues until society has reached the final revolution that is never to come, right? We always have to work on the material problems, even after a communist revolution. There'll be other tensions that we'll have to resolve. But the tensions that exist now promote and permit these people to continue to do these things. That's what we mean by a systemic problem. It's not that there were individual people that slipped through the cracks. It's that you know, there were yeah. systems in place that caused these people to continue to achieve power.
Sorry, so I think one other thing on this example. A liberal's first question would be, well, where are the parents? Why aren't the parents protecting their children from these predators? And this is just one example, but I think it's useful in how people can buy into things that actually harm them with good intentions. So like you have a kid and your kid has this dream and you're at this seminar and they say, I can make your kid's dream come true. And you get some benefit too. Like you get to pay, like you get some money or you get a promise of money. The kid wants it and you want it. Right. So then you have the best of intentions to make your kid's dream come true. And you, with those good intentions, put them in a situation to be utterly exploited. So I just wanted to throw that as an example, as like there are contextual ways that the things that we're talking about happen in all different kinds of industries across the world.
Yeah, those are good examples.
Yeah, for sure. So trying to focus us back a little bit on how to approach liberals, I think the first thing, and we've talked about it now to some extent, is to not go in guns blazing. You can't, my initial reaction is going to be angry that they are so blind to all of the things that are going on around them because they are complicit in them. And so you, attacking somebody for being complicit in the crimes of the system is counterproductive because it makes them defensive and they don't want to listen because you're being mean.
Yeah, so, they have this ridiculous idea of you can't have discourse if you don't have civility, which is something that just drives me crazy because, I mean, there is not a single, anti-communist or, person on the right that is going to engage with you in good faith.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
So the first thing you have to do is put aside that burning fire of anger that you're going to feel when they say something like, oh, well, you know, we're just trying to develop the underdeveloped world.
Insofar as you can do that.
Right, if it's possible. And I think, Red, you've had some experience with this now. You've been recently talking, I think, to a couple of your friends from various places that have that kind of progressive center-left standpoint.
Yeah, which I do feel, like I said, I am in a position to understand it. Like, I get where that idea, where those feelings come from. And it's an obsession with the perfect idea. If you do look at the models, you really can see, I think I mentioned that the book that set me on this path was called The End of Poverty by Jeffrey Sachs, who also was the person responsible for shock therapy when the USSR fell. And his book was basically, look, if we just put these correct ideas in place, if we just like made these ideas the ones that guided how we ran the global economy, we could end poverty by 2025, right? Like, whoa, like what amazing ideas you have. And if all of these ideas work in the real world, then, that'd be a great thing. And so you get very quickly wrapped up in assuming that the ideas work and assuming that for whatever reason that these ideas can affect reality in some magical way.
It's hard to determine where to approach a liberal. You have to decide what's important to them, I think, before you start talking about the labor theory of value or whatever. Because if you don't go, and I think this is a great insight from the Mass Line and from Maoism, if you don't go to where the person that you're talking to already is, you can't stand somewhere far advanced from their position and say, meet me here, because they simply will not do it.
Right, you gotta meet people where they are. Meet people where they are and try to give them examples that they can somewhat relate to or imagine. And I don't know what those are. That's very individual, which is kind of an echo that we keep reiterating, but it's true.
So when we do mass work, the idea is to find issues that people, that mass, large groups of people are passionate about. And I think the best piece of mass work that is out there right now, potential but not realized for communists anyway, and I think the anarchists have done a much better job at this, and I'm not sure why the supposedly revolutionary parties aren't doing this, is that we have these concentration camps now in the US that are rapidly going to become extermination camps. And there are a lot of people that are very upset about this. the kind of thing that we should be doing in mass work is organizing demonstrations, mass demonstrations. Because what happens is you get a bunch of liberals to go demonstrate. And this is something that Stalin pointed out in an article about organizing in the USSR. You have this big mass demonstration. And you have a lot of liberals in it, but they're passionate about their cause because they're progressive on this subject, because liberalism is an uneven ideology, and because the proletariat and the petit bourgeois develop at different rates, but they're very progressive on this one subject. And you go out and you stand in front of the ICE facility or whatever, and Stalin's example were Cossacks, but our example are just going to be regular old police. They come to stop you from demonstrating, because that's their job, is to make sure that the state can continue to function and that private property is protected. And do they politely ask you to leave? No, they mace you and handcuff you and throw you in a truck. And what happens is that you have your liberals now have had their first exposure to real state violence in person. And while they're watching their friends get dragged away or while they're going to lock up, you can then turn to them and say, that's the job of the police. They do this all the time, everywhere, with any threat to private property. This is a threat to private property. And you don't have to say much more than that, but that begins them on the process, because now they've had an experience that they can link up with your theory. Now they've experienced something personally that allows them to be activated. And not everybody will be, but the people that were passionate enough to go out there and risk the cops, even though they didn't really understand what it meant, are the kind of people that are going to be more likely to be activated by experiencing violence. And Stalin categorizes this as saying, when you go out on a march, there are Cossacks to prevent you from marching. And when they use their whips, they're going to whip members of the party, but they don't have real great control over them. And they're just going to whip bystanders. And that's going to cause those people to come onto your side. They're going to take a position because they are no longer just bystanders watching something that's not happening to them. They're people who are invested materially in the outcome of the situation.
Yeah, I think that's really, really important, especially when it comes to how we get people up and out, and when it comes to, I can't tell you how many liberals I've talked to who really do think that problems with police are not systemic, they're individual, and if they were to go out and see, even if it doesn't escalate to the police beating the crowd or something, because that happens sometimes, but not all the time, even just seeing the antagonistic relationship between the cops and the people, many white liberals in the Imperial Corps have never experienced the cop as anything but like a helpful person who stands on the street corner and makes sure that no one robs them or something. And I think even just experiencing that antagonism for a moment will make them think, wait, why are they doing that? Like, how is this the world that I live in? I didn't think this is
how the
world
works. I don't know. Counterpoint for me is that we shouldn't have to you're talking about being the direct, having a direct experience with violence. But I just want to say that I don't think we should have to consume violence to acknowledge its existence. Like, I personally, I don't find it good to perpetuate images and video of people being abused by the state as a means of getting people on our side, because I feel like that, it's like a re-victimization for this person who was abused. And I don't think that, seeing videos of somebody being dehumanized like helps people see their humanity more. I think it's good for causing outrage in people that already understand it as a bad thing. And what it can do, I think, is re-traumatize people who are already on your side, and who.
I don't think it's helpful to share images of that, but I think there's something to be said for standing in a human chain or something and watching your friend get clubbed in the head. You take a different view.
Yeah, I'm definitely not refuting that. I'm thinking more in terms of like online kind of faux activism that a lot of liberals engage in. This is one thing, is the consumption and sharing of violence as quote unquote praxis, which it, you know, does nothing really. It you're only going to be affecting the people that already know that this is wrong, and it's not going to get anyone new to like want to participate in ending this kind of oppression. So that was just, a little distinction that I wanted to draw there, but I totally get your point too.
Oh, I mean, I was just going to say, I totally agree with that. And I think that's part of why, you know, as we keep talking about this, you know, liberalism is so insidious, because someone who is not already radicalized will watch a video of a cop beating up a protester or whatever, and their first thought is, well, what's going on in that policeman's brain? They must be like just really angry and mad, and you know, surely most cops aren't like that, right? It doesn't help to show a liberal a video of this happening. It does help to have them in the shoes at the place so that they can actually experience it, because as I said, viewing it, they're just going to immediately try and go to straight to ideas.
A piece of liberalism actually that we have to confront inside the pseudo-Marxist left, that we can do effective praxis online. It's not possible. Twitter is designed like, is a piece of capitalization software designed to capitalize off of individual reactions, and it thrives on people talking to each other over and over. Which the best way to get that to happen is to make people mad at each other. So Twitter is an anger engine that's designed to direct clicks to things and make money for the Twitter corporation. It's very hard to do any kind of praxis or quote unquote organizing on Twitter. The best you can hope for is that you can do counter propaganda. And that's really the only thing a serious leftist should be considering. Like, you could shitpost whatever, that's neither here nor there. But if you're thinking of your Twitter work, quote unquote, as praxis, that's not the field to do it in. You can do some counter propaganda.
Well, I mean, you can also use it as a live communication tool to connect people to local events and things.
Sure.
But I totally see your point. I don't know. I think social media is kind of like a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, it allows people to find community in their values and in their interests. And on the other hand, you know, it's the arm of the corporate world we live in that's like literally spying on our deepest thoughts, our private conversations, our values, what makes us feel emotions. They're gathering all of that data and using it to like sell us more shit. I mean, how many ads did you see walking out the door today? Like, we are inundated. How many logos can you see just looking around you right now? I see a fuckload, and I'm at my home, you know, like I'm getting off on a tangent, but I think that it's important to understand how utterly inundated we are with capitalist propaganda and liberal propaganda. And if you can explain to a person that the talking points that they're parroting, don't come from a good place, or if you can explain to them why it's flawed and give them other words, that's a good starting point too. I find that a lot of like political propaganda, like stickers, things that are easy to share can be helpful. And that's, I think, what we're trying to do with the Redbubble as well. But it's hard. It's hard. I have a sticker on my laptop that says black lives are greater than white feelings, and some TSA agent in London had my computer and was putting it through the scanner, and she like made a sneer, looked up and like scoffed and pointed to her coworker and was like, "Ugh, look at this." So I just think, you know, like there's Whoa. There's people all over the place that are gonna be turned off by certain words, and we have to just be open to, I don't know. If that person wasn't a TSA agent, I would have just told her to fuck off, but I didn't want to go to airport jail.
Yep.
That was a weird, weird tangent to go off of.
No. I mean, that's a good example though of how status quo ideology kind of infects people, right? Because, I mean, how objectionable is it to say Black Lives Matter more than white feelings, right? Like, that is not
an objective statement. Right, like, it's, how is that offensive to you? I don't even understand.
Yeah, well, the reason it's offensive is because it's attacking the status quo ideology, which is that white feelings matter more than black lives. And so, you know, and really what it is because it's a sticker, I feel like, that because you put a sticker on your laptop, you're, the TSA agent is assuming you're trying to make a statement with it. And so therefore, by making this statement, you are implying that the status quo ideology is the opposite. And in fact, it is. But because the ideas are so unimpeachable to a liberal, I feel like that has to be what that person was thinking is like, oh, look at this person who is attacking the
status quo ideology. Well, this person was not a liberal. I can tell you that much. This person was extremely conservative, British, bumblefuck, whatever. But
conservative, like, again, you know, by the way we're using the word liberal, I think that conservatives such as that would fall well within the
liberal. Yeah, that's true. It's hard to separate the colloquial from the theoretical use of liberal for me, because I think that it's thrown around so interdependently in society that it's like the conversations like overlap and the lines kind of get blurred.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, it is difficult, especially, you know, if you're in, I'm in Canada at the moment, and here there is a capital L Liberal Party and a capital C Conservative Party, and by this definition, they're both liberal, you know, because they both are, whatever, looking, they're both focused on ideas, they're both very neoliberal, in fact, you know, in the States and in Canada as well. People who are conservative, quote unquote conservative, they belong to the Conservative Party, either the Republicans or the capital C Conservatives, are totally inundated with neoliberalism. And the same thing goes for the UK as well. You know, as far as neoliberalism, that we're talking, you know, Margaret Thatcher style neoliberalism, which often involves, you know, imperialism, a blindness to the horrors of imperialism, a focus on the individual to the exclusion of literally anything and everything else.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, have we answered the question how to talk to liberals? I'm not sure. I think we've, you know, had some good tips. Experience is key. People need to, unfortunately, experience the world for themselves before they're willing to extend empathy and compassion to everybody. I think you need to use ideas and experiences interchangeably. Like, because the liberal is consumed with ideas, you have to slowly interject experiences and materialism into their analysis. So it's like you have to start off accepting some of the idealism just to get to the point where you're talking at the same level. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a good kind of summary of some of the stuff we talked about as well, to kind of go back and think about the different tactics that we've talked about.
I would be really interested to hear the perspective from our audience. Is there like some kind of hashtag we can throw up so people can share their tips for this, or maybe just add us on Twitter and tell us what you think?
Yeah, why not? Just add us on Twitter and give us your notions about talking to liberals.
Yeah, maybe we can read some of the feedback in the next episode. I think that would be good. A good way to circle back to it, because, you know, we might have similar ideas to you. You might have things we haven't thought of. Our conversation might have meandered on a tangent and we missed something obvious. So share your thoughts of how you've talked to liberals and what your strategies are, and we can read them on the air.
All right, then. And with that, I suppose we will say goodbye. We're coming up on an hour mark. And I think that's, unless there was anything else anybody wanted to talk about.
Not for me. No.
Hearing nothing. All right. So just to run through again, thank you so much for listening. Please continue to subscribe, continue to share with your friends, continue to talk to us on Twitter, through email, the website. you know, if you want to follow us on Patreon, we are extremely grateful for that kind of thing. Thanks again to at Cathartic Skelly for the help with the production, cleaning things up so it sounds wonderful for all of you. I also hope you're enjoying our series of readings from chapters of State and Revolution. That will continue until we have finished State and Revolution. And yeah, continue talking to us. Let us know what you want to hear next. And I suppose that's it.
Take care, comrades.
Thanks so much for listening.